Radio Influence, podcasting redefined.
Welcome to the April 14th, 2020 edition of the MMA Report podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Floyd, and come here on this week's edition of the show. We're going to talk about UFC 249 being canceled last week when me and Daniel did a show. The show was on, and of course, 48 hours later, it was postponed. And ultimately, the timeline of events is Governor Newsom of California calling Disney and Disney telling Dana White, yeah, you should not go with the show. So we'll talk about that. Also, to kind of talk about, you know, we've mentioned here on the past couple of weeks of, you know, when MMA does resume, that we're going to have a crap ton of awesome fights. And so Daniel and I are going to break down our top at 10 MMA fights that are to come this year. Also, we'll give you some honorable mentions. Plus, we will continue our countdown of the top 100 current MMA fighters this week. We're going to count down from 90 to 81. Of course, a great way to show your support for this podcast is by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, or TuneIn Radio. Really do appreciate everyone that does leave a rating and review. Really do love those five-star reviews. And it's a great way to show your support for a show. It doesn't cost you anything. So as always, appreciate you taking time out of your day to download this podcast. Hopefully everything in your world is going okay. I can tell you in my world, Daniel, it is there are days where I'm just like, what the hell do I do? That was this past weekend. I think both days I took about a 3 or 4 hour nap in the afternoon. So I am definitely ready for life to get back to normal. But man, it, you know, a couple weeks ago, we were kind of going back and forth of, hey man, is there going to come a point where we're going to struggle with topics? But man, in the MMA world, there is always topics to talk about.
Yeah, it changes day to day. We were talking about a fight card that was just announced last week, and like you mentioned, within 48 hours, that fight card was canceled. And credit Dana White and everyone associated with the MMA world. We know how to keep things interesting, and we have certainly done that thus far. It sucks that we will not be able to watch UFC 249. I was looking forward to the fight card, but I'm glad the fight card was canceled. And the reason why I'm glad is because in the middle of April, I don't know if it was a good idea to run a fight card. I'm glad for the safety of the fighters, but I can tell you what, man, when we were recording the podcast last week, I was really, even though I wanted them to not run a show, I still was like deep down inside, I wanted to see a fight card, especially the fight card that they had laid out. So it's a very interesting point of view, Jason, where on one hand, I want to see fights, but as someone who is fortunate to not have had anyone in my family get the coronavirus, I still read news reports every day. And man, I think me and you are really lucky to be in the position that we are in, where our biggest problem is trying to figure out how to spend our time rather than like having to know a family member that may be on like a ventilator or something like that.
Exactly. I mean, I have friends who have had, you know, people that they know that have come down with coronavirus. You know, one of our shows here on Radio Influence, Southern Hospitality, they knew a DJ who was 38 years old and ultimately came down with coronavirus and passed away from it. Now, he did have the pre-existing condition of asthma, which is part of it. But yeah, I've not had anyone close to me come down with it. And, you know, look, it's when you look at the timeline of events of everything that happened, you know, last week, you know, we typically record this show here on late Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon. As we record this show, it's actually just a little after 11 a.m. Eastern time here on April the 14th. But when you look at the timeline of events that have happened over the last week, of course, you know, it was beginning of last week when Dana White announced what UFC 249 was going to be. Of course, he never, not till, you know, after his fight card was canceled, that he finally truly mentioned where it was going to be at, which was going to be at Taji Palace there, which is just outside of Fresno, California. Of course, that location was reported initially by Chef Sherwood, of course, you know, the founder of SureDog.com. Of course, not with SureDog anymore. And, you know, New York Times had a story. I had a story on Tuesday evening, a statement from the Association of Boxing Commission and Combative Sports Board of Directors about their concerns about UFC 249 and the regulation of it. The next day, the next morning, I got a statement from ABC president Brian Dunn. I can tell you, I talked to the UFC on Tuesday night about it after my story went out there, which, you know, look, my story, it didn't have any opinion on it. It was just simply, you know, what the statements were from the ABC board of directors, which it was very clear that, Dana White and Hunter Campbell saw those quotes very clear where they, their thoughts were on that. And I think the one thing I will say about that story, Daniel, is I think people need to read between the lines. You need to look at of when those quotes were given to me. So that was Tuesday evening of last week and Wednesday morning of last week. And you kind of see how things transpired. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the UFC was going to self-regulate the event, and they were going to run it how they regulate international events, which is by using people who work for the Nevada Commission as doctors, inspectors, and so on. So they were going to do it that way. But of course, the big part of that was this was going to be the first time that I believe in the UFC history that they were going to self-regulate an event in the United States. And John McCarthy on his podcast went into great lengths on that. And then of course you had, you know, managers once this thing was canceled, talking about the political side of it. We had managers, looking at the media, which, you know, Daniel, to me, the media and politicians, I believe, are an easy scapegoat. And, you know, we always talk about it is, you know, we don't want to sit here and talk politics because, you know, either you're going to feel one way or the other. And we're, you know, you're either going to like what we say, you're going to be pissed off what we say. But unfortunately, politics has entered our world. I mean, we've always known that Dana White is a huge supporter of President Donald Trump. But now you see with what Governor Newsom of California did, Dianne Feinstein, the senator, out of California, of course, they're both a Democrat. And of course, it as the past couple of days have happened and seeing things, especially from managers and particularly Malki Kawa and Ali Abdelaziz, I'm in more of the belief, and look, and Daniel, certainly I could be wrong, but I am really in the belief that how the UFC sold this to those two men is that this was politically motivated. And it wasn't the fact of, I don't know, we're in a global goddamn pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame that a pandemic has become political. I mean, the way I look at it, I think the perfect word to describe what has gone on is the word gaslighting, which the definition is to manipulate someone by psychological means into questioning their own sanity. And I tell you what, all of these statements are making me question my own sanity because I'm just like, what's going on here, guys? Like, I'm sorry that the event got canceled. I want to see mixed martial arts. I love mixed martial arts. The problem is we are dealing with an unprecedented, unknown global pandemic that is taking lives away from Americans. So the idea that they are trying to shift the narrative, to shift the anger towards the media and politicians, is downright insane. It makes no sense because the problem is there is no room in this discussion for these types of conversations. And the reason being is the entirety of the conversation should be spent on how can we run an event when it is acceptable? And how can we do it safely? Those are the two questions the UFC and the managers should try and answer, because those are the most important questions, not only for the fighters fighting, but for people who live in populations surrounding the area where fighters live. So that's where all of our energy should be in. But to use the media as a scapegoat, to use politicians as a scapegoat, isn't particularly helpful. Sports will come back in this society before they should. That's what will happen, Jason, because this society, myself included, is addicted to sports, and people in sports are big fans of making money. That's how we pay our bills. So sports are going to come back before public health officials deep in their hearts believe they should. I'm telling you that right now. They might come out with statements of when to reopen businesses and whatnot, but the pressure of putting on a sporting event is going to come before they really should. It's as simple as that. There is no reason when we may not have reached our peak that they were trying to run an event. Because it's as simple as this. As I mentioned, and when we talked about the Brazil show, the coronavirus is something that spreads, especially with people who are asymptomatic, who don't show symptoms, may not have an increased temperature. And the only way they measured the fighters in Brazil to see if they did or did not have COVID-19 was through checking their temperature, which does not do enough. So that was an issue. You couldn't tell me that everyone there didn't have COVID-19 because some people are asymptomatic. Now, as we live here in April, Jason, I just read an article this morning about how in New Jersey, there's a backlog of testing. People can't get tested unless they have symptoms. So if we have states, epicenters that can't get tested, it is unethical to run an event where in order for it to be safe, you would have to use tests to confirm that people don't have the disease. It would be unethical to run an event, Jason, and have those tests be used for that event that we just created rather than for people who are in an epicenter who may have symptoms. So that's my general takeaway, Jason. We cannot have an MMA event until the testing resources are there to ensure that everyone with symptoms is able to get tested, because we can't be taking away tests from those people.
You know, and that's always been the thing that we've talked about here on the show, is that, yes, we want to see live sports, whether we're talking about MMA or any other sport. But, you know, the other part of this is making sure that, you know, we're putting athletes in a safe environment. And you know, look, and that's where, whether you're the UFC, you're Bellator, or any other sports league, that you're relying on health officials to make that decision. But, you know, one of the things, and look, on the manager's aspect, if I was going to put my shoes in Malky's position, in Ali's position, would I probably take the same stance they are? I probably would, Daniel.
I wouldn't, because the thing is, what, let's look at it this way. If you're a manager, the only thing that you, the only value you provide to the UFC, a real value, is your fighters. Kissing their ass on social media doesn't mean jack, because in this business, and it's a business, the only thing that matters is money. And to me, ostracizing the media to earn brownie points, those checks don't cash later, I don't think. These are guys in Ali and Malky who are already, like, they have the leverage to not kiss Dana White's ass. And again, it's like, you don't need to do that, because it doesn't necessarily matter. It will be forgotten. And from my point of view, if you are a manager, there is much more value to the fighter to not have that type of relationship with the organization. It's good to have a good relationship, but if you're a manager and you are playing the role of public relations for the promotion, where you are representing a fighter who's trying to get the most money out of the promotion, trying to get the best deal out of the promotion, I would have serious questions if I was a fighter. So personally, if I was a manager, Jason, I would not have taken that task. I really wouldn't have.
Now, something to mention. So on Sunday, on Easter, me and Sam did a show, Sam Kaplan, a show of the Insiders podcast, where we talked about, you know, UFC 249 being postponed. And, you know, I put up this, you know, just a preview clip of the show, and Malky did respond, where he tweeted, LMAO, if you think this isn't political, you're crazy. Dan's relationship with Trump has put the Democratic leaders on a war path. You have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. You know, there's a couple other tweets. And then Rob Macy, of course, obviously involved with, attempting to get the Ali Act expanded to mixed martial arts, also with the antitrust lawsuit. Where Malky basically is stating of, you don't know what you're talking about. And Rob simply responds with, you don't know more than we do, Malky. That is for sure. What we know doesn't speak well for you. And there was another tweet where Nate Quarry, of course, he's involved in that antitrust lawsuit, that basically alludes to the fact of, hey, when some details come out, there's going to be some things that don't necessarily make managers look the best. And, you know, but then as we talk about the timeline, this also then takes a turn on Monday, when the Florida County mayor called the WWE. He deemed them an essential business. And this is Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings. I'm hoping I pronounced that correctly. According to him, he said WWE initially was not designed as an essential and therefore was not exempt from the state's shelter in place order, which took effect on April 3rd and runs through at least April 30th. The decision was reversed after some conversation with DeSantis' office. And this is from an article from ESPN.com where it says essential businesses that are supposed to remain open during Florida's stay-at-home order include those in the healthcare, financial, energy, food, communications, and transportation sectors. According to this memo sent by the governor's office on Thursday, recent additions to the list of essential services in the state include quote-unquote employees at a professional sports and media production with a national audience, including any athletes, entertainers, production team, executive team, media team, and others necessary to facilitate, including services supporting such production, only if the location is closed to the general public. A spokesperson from DeSantis' office told ESPN on Monday that such services were characterized as essential because they are critical to Florida's economy. Asked if they would apply to UFC events, a spokesman said, quote, the memo does not specify specific sports, if I can say that correctly, as long as the event location is closed to the general public. I think another aspect of this story is the fact of Linda McMahon runs Trump's 2020 PAC. So I think that's an aspect because obviously the WWE was potentially could be in violation of their television contract with Fox. And I'll just say this as a Florida resident, it's something interesting to monitor, Daniel, as not just as a Florida resident, but also as a Florida business owner that my business is not considered essential business because look, A, we can run the business remotely, but I'm sure there are probably businesses in Orange County, Florida that are looking at that statement going, whoa, whoa, whoa. How is a television show exempt from this? And they can film, but maybe I can't go in my office and handle my day in, day out operations and try to bring money into my business. I think that's a question going forward, but we are seeing other political leaders, you know, kind of talking about opening things up. The Nevada governor, he tweeted out on Monday evening. He said Nevada's state specific plan to phase out the current stay at home order directives and reopen our economy was driven by the advice of medical experts to ensure the health and safety of our residents, in addition to the millions of visitors we welcome every year as a premier domestic and international travel destination. I understand that because of Nevada's position as one of the leading tourist hubs in the world, our state has a unique challenge of enacting the highest safety standards possible. I view this challenge as a great opportunity and will work with my fellow Western regional governors, leaders from around the country, and local governments across Nevada to ensure our residents and future visitors know there's a strong plan in place when we reopen for business. And Daniel, I feel like we do have to note the governor of Nevada is a Democrat. Now, obviously, here in Florida, the governor is a Republican who is, you know, obviously has been a massive supporter for Donald Trump. And I hate to sit here and talk about the politics aspect of it, but there is that. But, you know, to me, it does seem that we are heading in a direction where I think maybe Fight Island is not necessarily going to be something that the UFC has to do, because I think if you look at, you know, what's happening here in Florida, you look at that statement from Nevada, I think the UFC is going to have some options here in the United States to do events if they want to go that route.
Yeah, yeah. Republican or Democrat, I want to say across the board, I really lack trust for either political party because I'm just angry, right? Living through this time, I'm angry. So across the board, across the political spectrum, I have a lack of trust in the government. And you mentioned Nevada, you mentioned Florida looking to reopen things up. You have a Democratic governor in one state, a Republican in the other. When I look at both states, there's a lot of mumbo jumbo there about how we listen to the medical professionals. And I'm going to be honest with you, Jason. I have a real lack of trust in these people because I feel like the most important words was when you mentioned the Florida deal where they justified WWE being essential business. And the most important words is essentially, I'm paraphrasing here based on what you said, but it was like WWE is essential because it's beneficial to, quote unquote, our economy. And that is the great battle that is being waged here. And they don't work in congruence, Jason. On one side, money. We need money. Our economy is big and huge. On the other side, public health. Those two things don't work together. And as I read more and more about the coronavirus every day, I really feel like, from my own point of view, Jason, I just think we need to prioritize, first and foremost, getting the resources together to test everyone, and also like just have the resources in place to, like, when we eliminate social distancing practices, we can do so in a very intelligent way. But my problem is, I feel as though we are eliminating social distancing practices without a practical way to ensure that we don't see another spike in the amount of people that have COVID-19. Like, it just feels like we're just opening up more and more places. And that's across the board politically. That's just what I wanted to say about that. I don't think the WWE should be running at all. I was disappointed in both them and All Elite Wrestling for running shows over the past month. Both promotions really disappointed me because they are not essential. They are an entertainment product that can take a few months off and run reruns. They can do that. And much like the UFC, Jason, these are co-workers who don't sit at a desk. They touch each other like crazy. I mean, the only place where more germs are switched between two bodies is in the pornography industry, okay? It's porn, wrestling, and MMA. Those are the top three businesses that you can guarantee germs are going to be switched around. So that's all of that is just my general point on coronavirus and in terms of, like, let's chill out, all right? But I think the UFC is going to have an opportunity to put on events in Florida. I think all sporting companies will be able to do that in Florida, and looks like Nevada eventually. I don't think that's a good thing, but just to circle back to Fight Island, you begin to wonder how much money was spent by the UFC on Fight Island when they could just run an event in Florida. You feel for them, and just to circle back, I want to see MMA, Jason. I desperately do. I just think we need to make sure that we have a very smart plan in place. And I have a real lack of confidence that that will take place.
You know, it's this question that we got in on Twitter from, Joe from Houston, where he says, how is WWE deemed essential business? And Joe, I don't know. I mean, outside of follow the money, I guess is about the best way to describe why it's considered an essential business. I mean, you know, I'm sure that there's probably going to be people that, report on politics here in the state of Florida that are probably going to be investigating this of why just magically all of a sudden, you know, that this was deemed essential business. And as the quote from the ESPN article from a spokesperson from DeSantis' office that said, quote, because they are critical to Florida's economy. And look, I think that it's, you know, every politician is trying to figure out how can you restart the economy. I mean, look, I can tell you, as someone who his business is based on the advertising business, you know, everyone knows the economy is absolutely hurting, but, you know, it's one of those things of you would love to sit there and have a true sit down conversation with, whether it's Vince McMahon, it's Stephanie McMahon, it's Triple H, Shane McMahon, whoever in WWE, and say, please explain to me why you believe you're an essential business right now. I don't think you can sell it to me. I don't think there's a way you could sell it to me.
Yeah, and they're going to give you some mumbo jumbo about how, oh, we're going to be a distraction, a sign of hope. And, like, look, oh, God, I cannot wait until we get sports back. I'm like, scratching my neck, and I can't wait. But it's a bunch of malarkey. It really is. Because, again and again, we are dealing with something in life that is unprecedented and unknown, and we got to treat it as such. We have to respect what's going on, because if we don't respect it, it's going to take more lives. And again, Jason, if we start opening things up, things are going to get closed because people are going to get sick regardless. I mean, there were towns in Texas back in the Spanish flu who just did not close stuff down while other cities did, and they were obliterated. So again, I just feel like even if we make the decision to open up the economy more with sporting events, it's going to have a double-edged sword because people are still going to get sick. So the WWE would not do a good job of convincing either of us, because it's not like the way I look at it is the only essential business that I think should be open are news organizations who are informing the public. That is essential. That is essential, as is groceries, as is obviously medical people and other stuff, you know, like car people who take care of cars or whatever, fix cars. Like, obviously that's essential. WWE is not, but again, it's all about the money, and at least I'll give Florida credit. I mean, they admitted what it was. I mean, they said that it was going to help the economy. That was the reason why they deemed it essential. Is it a good reason? I certainly don't think so. And I tell you what, I don't think the WWE's shows without fans is generating that much money for the Florida economy. I'll tell you that much too.
Yeah, that's my thing, is I sit there and go, how is this helping the Florida economy? Maybe is it some type of tax revenue that the WWE pays the state of Florida when the performance center's open? I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, it's really unknown. And, you know, look, as we said, we want to see fights, but at the end of the day, it's about, are we putting, you know, the athletes and everyone involved in working the event in a proper place? I mean, like, I'm not sure if we talked about this last week on the show or not, but like, you think about when they were going to go to Tachi Palace for UFC 249. If the UFC and Dana White or anyone in the UFC had called me and said, Jason, we've got a press pass for you to come out to cover this event here at Tachi, my answer would have been no. I know there were other reporters that were willing to do it. I couldn't do it. There's no way I would accept that, just because of I would be so concerned about me flying from Florida to California and back, and what would happen if somehow I came down with it and brought it back to my family.
Yeah. And again, a common theme I'm giving you is the word unknown, because the thing is, you don't know how you could theoretically get it, man. Like, we don't have a good handle on how this disease spreads. That is so important, because you can't guarantee that you will go there and come back without getting the coronavirus, because we don't have a good handle on what's going on in the first place. So the thing is, like, we do need to exercise patience and discipline and showcase a level of maturity, because this is not influenza. This is a situation in which, simply put, we don't know what's going on. And to talk about how we talk to the medical professionals and everybody's going to be safe. No, you are feeding us literal lies, because if the medical professionals who are guaranteeing safety or making all this stuff should not be talking to you, they should probably be talking to the World Health Organization, because we need those geniuses to inform us that aspect, because this is a disease. There are so many questions. Jason, we don't know so much. And again, we got to be patient. What I appreciate about Dana White, you know, it's important to say nice stuff, because we are negative here, but justifiably so. So I will tell you this. What I liked about Dana White's comments was I appreciated him saying that they would run an event in Taichi Palace, because, like, even though it was a mistake for Taichi to accept this thing, because again, it's irresponsible, I appreciate, like, the sense of, like, loyalty. Like, all right, you were going to scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And again, I genuinely appreciate Dana White's work ethic. I genuinely appreciate his attitude. It helped the UFC so much to grow so big. And I love that about him, because it really helped this sport grow. But the problem with Dana is, during this situation, this attitude is a big time negative, and he just needed to have been reined back in. And to blame anyone else, it's something where you are not taking responsibility. And this is a sport that's built on discipline and responsibility. And throughout this pandemic, we've seen the top people, whether it be Dana White or the top fighter, whether it be John Jones, exhibit a significant lack of responsibility and discipline.
You know, the one story that has not been talked about a lot over the last week was a story that was written by Guillerme Cruz on April the 7th, where it talked about how Eric Silva, the current Bellator welterweight, of course, fought in the UFC. His whole family has been infected with coronavirus in Brazil, where his quote was, "We have no idea how it got us." And we really haven't seen a lot of, you know, articles about there of whether, you know, MMA fighter has contracted this or whatnot. I mean, I know I saw the MMA junkie piece on Alistair Overeem that, you know, he's kind of, you know, thinking whether he had it at some time or not. And, you know, and sometimes I, you know, I mean, look, it's a serious thing. And look, and kudos to Dana White, because he nearly pulled this thing off. You know, if Governor Newsom doesn't make that call to Disney, Daniel, I think we're, this whole show is a preview for UFC 249. I truly believe that.
Yeah, I think so, man. I think so. And that would have been a lot of fun to talk about for sure. But it's something where, honestly, it just feels like there's no way Governor Newsom would not have made that call. Again, this is a guy and Gavin Newsom who's really like been aggressive with this stuff, as has most governors, Republican and Democrat alike. So I would love to have talked about UFC 249. But I mean, again, it's like not only Newsom, but you mentioned Feinstein. I felt like she kind of set the wick here, set the match, and then it got to Disney. So it would have been interesting to see if anything else would have caused the UFC to pull the plug. I don't think so. The other thing I wanted to mention positively for Dana White is I appreciated him in that interview with Brett Okamoto talking about how he wasn't going to lay off any UFC employees. That is something to be commended. So there's that too. But yeah, I feel bad for Eric Silva. I hope he gets healthy. I think this is also what we're seeing with a lot of private companies, including grocery stores, for God's sakes, is they are telling their employees to keep it hush hush. So I do wonder how many people in the UFC may have it, and they've been told to not disclose that. Because I guarantee you that the WWE has more than just the one case they've announced. They announced that one non-roster talent had the coronavirus, I believe is what they said. And I'm telling you, man, if a professional wrestler had the coronavirus, I strongly believe Vince McMahon would have told him, do not let this get out. And I feel like these private companies have those types of cultures where they know if someone under their employ gets out with the coronavirus, that would be a huge, huge media storm.
Oh, so
that's
yeah.
That's a big question I have, is how many fighters, how many professional wrestlers have coronavirus that have not disclosed that to the public?
No, that's a great point. Another point I want to bring up before we kind of move on to another topic is that, you know, obviously Tachi Palace, Indian reservation, but they do not have their own regulatory commission. So this is not like when, say, Bellator goes to Mohegan, Bellator goes to Windstar there in Thackerville. You know, in Thackerville, it is a Chickasaw Nation commission. They're under the ABC umbrella. Obviously, Mohegan Tribe underneath the ABC umbrella as well. So it is Andy Foster's responsibility to inform the governor of what was going on. Whether you hate Governor Newsom for doing what he did, you know, or whether you support him, you have to understand that from Andy Foster's position as the executive director of the California State Athletic Commission, he has to inform his boss, who is the governor, that, hey, just FYI, I need to let you know something, that the Ultimate Fighting Championships is attempting to do a show at Tachi Palace. They're going to self-regulate this thing. So it was his responsibility to tell Gavin Newsom that, because if he doesn't tell the governor that, Daniel, and then the governor finds out after the fact that, you know, hey, this show happened, and he goes to my athletic commission, go, why didn't you tell me? Andy Foster's probably without a job.
Yeah, especially in a situation like this where things are so dramatic and dire. Yeah, that's a responsibility for him, because, you know, that's his boss. And this is a deal where it's all hands on deck, and people need to be aware of what's going on. So it's something where he likely did not have to tell him, because it would have blown up anyway. But that's how it works in this type of situation. Such a strange circumstance and so blatantly obvious. And I think this sport should not be running away from regulation anymore. It's not the 1990s.
Yeah.
We're in 2020. You're on ESPN. You're a part of the mainstream. when you make mainstream money, you got to adhere to mainstream rules.
Yeah, you're not going to, you know, you can't fly under the radar in 2020. It's not 1995 anymore. But, you know, as we've talked about is, you know, while, you know, the negative of not having fights right now, you know, sucks because, look, I would love to be able to sit on my couch on Saturday night and watch UFC 249. But when we do return to normal life in mixed martial arts, and you know we're going to have a crap ton of MMA fights, there's no question about it. You know, Dana White has mentioned that they still want to give all the fights that they're contracted to give their television partner ESPN in 2020, which is 42 events. They've only done 8 events so far. So we wanted to look at the top MMA fights to come this year. Now, some of these fights are fights that have been booked previously, you know, that have been postponed, or, you know, are fights that we expect to happen, or maybe fights that we think should happen. Daniel, before we get into our top 10, I want to go over some of my honorable mentions, and we'll see if you have some of these. So I have 4 UFC fights and 4 Bellator fights. I'll start with the UFC fights, and these are in no particular order. Colby Covington versus Tyron Woodley, Stipe Miocic against Daniel Cormier, Francis Ngannou against Jair Rozenstruik, Marlon Moraes versus Peter Yan. On the Bellator side, Michael Chandler versus Benson Henderson, Patchy Mix versus Sergio Pettis, Emmanuel Sanchez versus Daniel Veitchel, and Ryan Bader versus Vadim Nemkov.
Wow. Your list is going to look a lot better than my list. I'll tell you that much. You've definitely got some fights on there that I don't have. And I think it's because I missed them. Because like these things are in flux. We're talking about fights that were canceled, fights that are rumored and whatnot. Damn, those are a lot of good fights. I mean, to me, the fight that sticks out the most that didn't make your list, and there's quite a few fights that you mentioned that are on my list, the Covington-Woodley matchup is the one that I didn't even consider that I would have definitely put on my list. Some other fights that you didn't mention that are part of my honorable mentions, Vicente Luque and Nico Price.
Okay, yeah.
Anthony Smith and Teixeira, not that sexy. Cynthia Caviello and Antonina Shevchenko is a fight I was looking forward to. Wyman Hermansson is there. Blades Volkov. And then Edson Barboza and Josh Emmett. What was a fight that I'm looking forward to if it happens, just because Edson Barboza is primetime viewing. But I'm excited to see which fights you have on your top 10 that I just completely missed.
So all those honorable mention fights are not fights that are in my top 10, but some great matchups. Cause I think when I was looking at, you know, top fights, as I was just kind of writing down fights, I went to the UFC rankings and I was kind of looking more at the top of the division more than, but I mean, you mentioned that Luque Price fight was going to be that was definitely a fight that I was looking forward to at UFC 249. And there's a ton of great fights that you mentioned there. We all know, I don't think there's any debate on what the number one fight is.
Yeah, the only positive UFC 249 not happening is that we're going to get, for what, the 7th time booked? Khabib and Tony Ferguson. It's going to be the 6th time? Okay. Khabib, Nurmagomedov, and Tony Ferguson. I mean, that's the no-brainer, number one. And I'm glad we're getting back towards that one. For the love of God in my life, I need to see those two men fight and determine who the pound for pound king is in lightweight. I mean, at this point, when these two fight, the winner will probably be known as the best lightweight fighter of all time.
Yeah, it's still like, I still like, you know, and I've seen a lot of people kind of saying, who are they going to pick? I still think, and I don't think my pick is going to change. My pick is Khabib Nurmagomedov. At one time, it was Tony Ferguson. But I think that as I look at this fight, I look at that fight, I think Khabib's my pick, you know, 8 out of 10 times.
I think my pick will be, I'm not sure who I'm picking here, but whoever it is, I'll pick them to win 6 out of 10 times. That's how razor thin this fight is. I think right now, in terms of fight preparation, I would favor Khabib. It seems like he's probably a little more focused than Tony. He's probably been all over the place, accepting fights against everyone and everyone.
Now, I know based on our pre-show meeting that our number twos are different. Now Daniel and I have not gone through our list, but as we were kind of going back and forth, I thought we both had the same number two, but clearly we don't. My number two is Conor versus whoever the hell is across the cage from him, whether that's Justin Gaethje, Nate Diaz, or Jorge Masvidal. What's your number two?
That's a great one, man. And the reason why we thought that we both had the same number two at first was like, I'm like, I actually have a fight where I don't even have an opponent. And you were like, me too. I'm like, oh, we probably had the same one, but we don't. I did not have a Connor fight on here just because the way I did it was I just went through all of the event pages on Wikipedia and looked at what was canceled and what was on the books. And then just a couple other things like, okay, this might happen. So I didn't do a lot of projecting here, so I didn't put a Connor fight on there, but that obviously would have been my number two. My number two is whoever the hell Henry Cejudo fights. That's my number two fight. That's the most appetizing contest, whether it be Aldo, Dominic Cruz. He is the only other, oh no, I have one other UFC champion on here, but he's one of the few UFC champions that has a fight pretty much booked in terms of we know what date it was supposed to happen and against who. So whoever the hell Henry Cejudo fights is my number two.
I did not have Cejudo in my top 10.
Okay.
Here's why. And if you told me he was defending the title against Aljamain Sterling, Petr Yan, I'm way more interested. I'm not interested in what we were supposed to see with Jose Aldo. Then it was going to be, you know, allegedly it's going to be Dominic Cruz. Like that just doesn't interest me. I mean, like when I saw the report that Dominic Cruz is getting the title shot, I was, and I'm like, cause I remember I woke up to the news and I'm going, who the hell did Dom Cruz fight last? And I literally had to Google it to see what it was. And you have to go to the end of, 2016, I think it was, 2017, whatever, 2018, whatever it was against Cody Garbrandt. I had completely forgot that was his last fight.
Yeah. He hasn't fought in over 3 years. It would be a money grab and it's a division where it's crazy because there's a backlog of guys. You mentioned Aljo, you mentioned Petr Yan, it's just an absolute backlog of fighters, and for Dominic Cruz to jump the guys is just insane. So I get that. It's just one of those things where I look at Henry Cejudo as just a tippity-top, pound-for-pound type caliber fighter, and any opportunity to see him fight excites me. But I'm excited to see who you have on this list because there are fights that you put on here that I did not even entertain. So I'm interested.
I've got five other UFC title fights.
Yeah, I only have one other UFC title fight. Okay, hit me with them. Hit me with another one.
All right, my number three.
Uh-huh.
Israel Adesanya versus Paulo Costa.
Damn. Yeah, I did not put that on my list. I did not know when this fight is happening. Wikipedia failed me so bad.
Well, we don't know when the fight's happening, but look, that's obviously the route they want to go going forward. Right. So, I mean, like, that's why, like, there's several fights on this that don't have an official date. We just kind of either I expect that's the way the UFC or Bellator is going to go, or I just think it's just a matter of time for that fight happens. But yeah, I mean, you look at obviously, you know, Adesanya Costa was a fight that we were hoping to see earlier this year. Of course, that did not happen due to the injury with Paulo Costa. And of course, Adesanya and Romero go out there and have a fight. By the way, I don't know if you saw this, that apparently, so Chris Weidman went through three opponent changes for, potential fights. And one of them was Yoel Romero. Does somebody hate Chris Weidman?
Yeah. Unless Yoel's going to fight like he did against Israel, which is just stand in the center of the cage. That's a bad night out for Weidman. That's a hell of, I mean, I guarantee you, I don't have Adesanya. Like my list is so much weaker. At number three, I have freaking AJ McKee and Darren Caldwell. That's my number three fight. Meanwhile, you probably have Usman Masvidal next, don't you?
No. Yeah. Usman Masvidal is number five. Oh, I put Caldwell McKee number six.
Okay. Oh, you know, we're close. What do you have? What do you have at three?
Three was Adesanya and Costa.
Oh, I'm an idiot. What do you have at four? What do you have at four?
Gegard Mousasi versus Douglas Lima.
You know what? We're in agreement here. I have that fight number four too. So for the love of God, I disagree. I think, even though it's not on my list, I think Usman Masvidal is a much more interesting fight than Lima Mousasi. I will tell you that much.
I think there are a lot of people who are basing their opinion on Mousasi versus Lima, basing it on what happened between Musasi and Rory McDonald. You know, look, it is, first off, Douglas Lima is not a small welterweight. He is not at all. I think it's going to be a fascinating matchup. I have Usman and Masvidal at number five. This is my thoughts about Usman and Masvidal is, what happens if Kamaru Usman implements a strong wrestling game? Will Jorge Masvidal have an answer to that?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, he does a good job of fighting from behind, getting scrambling back up, and he's got game changing power. And again, I have Liam Musasi four, but the issue I have with putting that one ahead of Usman Masvidal is Gegard Mousasi just doesn't get me up in the morning. You know what I'm saying? Like, his fight against Lyoto wasn't particularly great. It was a really rough performance against Lovato Jr. Mousasi Lima's one hell of a fight. In contrasting it with Masvidal Usman, I'm more hyped about that one. But at the end of the day, we are in agreement. I mean, Lima versus Mousasi is a quote-unquote super fight within Bellator. And it's a great opportunity for Douglas Lima to potentially, like, showcase himself as a pound for pound guy across the entire sport.
What's your number five fight?
So it's one of your honorable mentions, Ngannou Jair Rozenstruik. That's my number five fight. I think I kind of regret not putting the Peter Yan fight on my top 10, because I don't know why I blew that one over. But Ngannou Jair Rodriguez. I mean, Jair Rodriguez. That would be a rough fight if we have a heavyweight take on a featherweight. Yeah, you're Rozenstruik. It reminds me of when those two guys get inside the cage. I'm gonna get a little bit of goosebumps because it's gonna be kind of scary to see those two heavy hitters fight. I think if we're ranking the heaviest hitters in the entire UFC, those two guys are really high up the list. I mean, I would be interested to see the entire heavyweight division play that game where they punch the boxing thing. I mean, that machine would probably get broken. I just think that's like a don't blink heavyweight type fight. But for the love of God, if that one goes into the fifth round, we're in for a clunker.
Yeah, I mean, that's gonna be interesting to kind of see how Rozenstruik would you know bounce back after. I mean, look, he was on his way to losing that fight against Overeem, in my mind, until he lands that punch and of course ends the night for Alistair Overeem. You know, I mentioned number six for me is Caldwell McKee. I just think that's a great fight that's supposed to be June 6th for the next scheduled Bellator event. Of course, that's going to be one headline by Chandler and Henderson. Chandler Henderson is one of those fights that I know Bellator doesn't do five round non-title fights outside of tournament fights. That's a fight I wish was five rounds. But what's your number six fight?
I have another one of your honorable mentions. It's a light heavyweight fight in Bellator I'm looking forward to. Ryan Bader versus Vadim Nemkov is my number six fight. The reason being is Ryan Bader has really asserted himself as a dominant champion in Bellator in multiple divisions. And I feel as though Vadim Nemkov represents the most intriguing challenger Ryan Bader may have in his Bellator run. So that's why that's number six, is that Nemkov has showcased a great amount of upside. And this fight is very intriguing from the aspect of he might be the guy who has the best odds to dethrone Ryan Bader's championship run.
Now, my number seven fight is a light heavyweight matchup. John Jones versus Dom Reyes.
You see, the dude's on house arrest, Jason.
Aren't we all kind of on house arrest?
That's true. Your list is so much better than mine. If we put out a graphic of your list versus my list, I think I would get hit with rocks. Hell yeah. That's a great fight. I can't wait to see it. Yeah. I you can't go wrong with John Jones versus Dom Reyes, too. Who are you picking in that fight?
I would go John Jones. I think he'll make the changes to make sure it's not a close fight. I mean, we've seen Jones in these rematches. Him and his team make those adjustments. But, you know, I obviously the question is kind of, you know, we haven't seen John Jones, you know, rush to these rematches. Now, there's been obviously some issues on why he may not be able to rush to the rematches, but it's definitely a fight. What's your number seven?
I think Dom Reyes should ask John Jones to go to the cage first, and as like a mental tactic, he should come out to Sound of the Police by KRS-One. I mean, that would piss off John Jones so much. It's just police sirens, and then it's all about the mental edge. Number seven, this fight I'm not looking forward to because it will likely be a bloodbath, a beatdown, a destruction. Amanda Nunez vs. Felicia Spencer is not a particularly good fight. But the reason why it's number 7 is, again, an opportunity to watch greatness earns a spot on my list. This is not a good fight because there's a drastic difference like we've seen in Shevchenko's fights. But Nunez earns an automatic spot on my list because she's, you know, like the best female fighter of all time.
She wasn't on my list.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable. It's not a riveting matchup at all. I mean, it's going to be long odds for the champion.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you would imagine that Nunez is probably at least a 10-1 favorite in that fight. My number 8 fight is a fight that I'm more hoping Bellator makes this fight. I just don't know whether or not it'll truly happen. Lorenz Larkin versus Michael Page.
Oh, that would be one hell of a fight. Those two guys would that'd be intriguing, especially like the long frames of both guys and the way Larkin strikes compared to the counter approach of Page. That's a good fight, man. I'm down with that one. My number 8's also in Bellator, and it's the aforementioned Michael Chandler Benson Henderson scrap, a fight that I'm very much looking forward to. I like your opinion of doing a 5-round fight. These are two guys with championship reputations. So, yeah, we have a pair of Bellator fights in the number 8 slot.
Number 9 for me, I've got a UFC title fight, and that would be Weili Zhang defending her title, not against Joanna Jędrzejczyk, even though I think that's a route that you definitely could go. I feel like maybe build back up to that rematch. But I have her against Tatiana Suarez.
Oh, that's a good fight. I mean, I would book the rematch for sure. And I would do that because I would be scared of Joanna's inability to climb back up the ranks due to the fact that quite often when you go through absolute wars, you're just never the same fighter again. It takes a lot out of you. And this is a fighter in Joanna who's already showcased some signs of aggression. So I just wouldn't mess around and book the rematch. But Weili Zhang is just, you know, she gained a lot of stock from me. And so that's one hell of a fight to put there. And Tatiana's, you know, a heck of a challenger.
What's your number 9?
I have a Bellator fight here. Patricio Pitbull versus Pedro Carvalho. This is another matchup where I think the odds are going to be pretty wide for Pitbull as a favorite. But similar to the Nunez reasoning, I think we have a guy in Pitbull who, you know, may be the best Bellator fighter ever competing. And so any chance to see him fight is a chance that I will take, and I'll put him in my top 10.
Yeah, I did not have Patricio in my top 10. I mean, if you told me we're talking January 2021, I think he would definitely be in my list against, you know, potentially, you know, if he got there, obviously, maybe against, you know, AJ McKee or Darian Caldwell. My number 10 is another UFC title fight and a rematch, Volkanovski and Holloway.
Oh, damn. It's a good one. That's a good one. Like, you have the championship fight in the weight class, while my number 10 is just a measly contender bout among guys who are in the bottom half of the top 10. In fact, I have a fight between, you know, you picked at number 10, the featherweight champion against the number 1 challenger. I picked number 7 versus number 9 in the featherweight division. Your pick is much superior, but I have Jeremy Stephens, Calvin Kattar, number 10.
Yeah, I would tell you, I thought one of the most interesting things last week when the betting odds came out, the fact of how big of a favorite that Calvin Kattar was.
Yeah, especially a guy who's ranked below. And I think it's what we see quite often is fighters with name value are damaged goods versus the guy who's kind of climbing up the mountain. And Calvin Kattar's kind of playing that role.
I think one of the things, though, when you look at, you know, all these fights that we've mentioned, whether they're in our top 10 or honorable mention of, once we do get back to a normal MMA schedule and there's fights happening every week, we're going to have a great end of 2020 in terms of MMA fights.
Yeah, I can't wait, man. And the cool thing about it is I'm going to appreciate it so much.
Yeah.
You know, we were kind of getting force-fed cards every single week, sometimes multiple cards a week. And the gap of MMA action is going to that first fight card back is going to feel so awesome, and I cannot wait. So in addition to the fact that I'm just going to appreciate it more, much like in other sports where we're going to have multiple golf majors within a short span, truncated playoffs, hopefully, this is going to be good stuff. And it's not going to just be MMA. There's going to be a backlog of great boxing matchups. It'll be – I'm not really in tune to the boxing world, but I wonder if they have started talking about doing the empty arena deal like the UFC. Or because I just have not been in on that, but that'll be interesting.
Yeah, but I would have to imagine with that. I mean, you would have to think that that would really limit boxing purses. You would think.
Think about it. We were supposed to get Wilder Fury 2, and that's been pushed back because like they're building towards Fury Joshua, and they're just like, whatever. Let's just do that automatic rematch that Wilder has, and he's enacting. So like, we may not get those big type fights because the way it's been pushed back, Jason.
No, no.
You're right about the purse.
You know, I mean, and you're right. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, prior to all this, yeah, we took it for granted about, you know, the ability to sit down every week, whether you watch a fight card live or after the fact to be able to watch fights. So, you know, I think one of the interesting things from the Bellator aspect of this is we're so used to Bellator, you know, with their events being, you know, obviously the main card is full of fighters who are on multi-fight deals with them. And then the preliminary card is made up of a mixture of fighters who are either quote unquote on, you know, local ticket sellers, one fight type deals. And, you know, then a couple of fights, you know, featuring fighters who are on multi-fight deals. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see, you know, how does Bellator, when they do have the ability to do shows with fans, how will they kind of put those things together? It's going to be a very interesting time in MMA, looking forward to it. And I mean, look, I'm looking forward to some of these great fights, but you know, Daniel, last week on the show, we started our countdown of the top 100 current MMA fighters. We went from 100 to 91. This week, we're going to go from 90 to 81. Of course, this is a list that Daniel has put together. And, you know, the first thing that I will point out is number 90, right? When I see his name, and Daniel, you told me a fact that I just did not realize about this fighter. And that's Bibiano Fernandez. The fact of 2 weeks ago, this guy turned 40 years old.
It's crazy, man. He has a very youthful baby face.
Oh, yes, he does.
He could pass as someone who's like 22 years old, and I have him number 90. I mean, this is a long-term what-if candidate in terms of what if he went to the UFC. He's been a tippity-top bantamweight outside the UFC for a very long time. I mean, I think a lot of fans first were exposed to him with his success in the bantamweight tournament. He's just an unbelievable jiu-jitsu practitioner. He's had 8 successful title defenses of the 1FC bantamweight championship. This is a guy who's obviously 40 years old, so he's past his athletic prime. But he's incredibly talented. And again, you mentioned prior recording, one of the big what ifs for Bibiano is what would have happened if he signed with the UFC, and he was dangerously close to doing so.
Yeah, if you remember, I want to say it was before UFC 149, which I want to say that was going to be in Alberta, Canada, or somewhere up in Western Canada. And of course, you know, and ultimately, you know, it was, you know, reported that he had signed with UFC, he was going to make his debut. Ultimately, that did not happen. You know, and we always talk about these great fighters that train with each other. Like, I feel like right now, a lot of people would pay to watch Demetrius Johnson and Bibiano Fernandez have a sparring session there at AMC Pancration.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, that would be so fun to watch. I mean, those guys are two of the top 3 or 4 talents within 1FC. So, yeah, I think Fernandez, I mean, he's fought Kevin Bellinon like 400 times already. It'd be interesting to see how much longer he fights. But, again, yeah, he's number 90.
And number 89, we're sticking at one championships.
Yeah, I wanted to have a great diversity on my list. This is a different weight class. I went with Timothy Nasukin, and this is primarily based on one performance, his March 2019 knockout over Eddie Alvarez. It shocked the world, I felt like. I mean, there are people afterwards, and there's been a lot of smoke afterwards, where they're like, oh, I saw this one coming. He was an absolute killer. And so you see the huge knockout over Eddie Alvarez. Then you listen to people who train with him. You watch some of his prior fights. And even though he's only had one performance that I've seen, you get really excited about the potential. So we have a nice dichotomy where at number 90, Bibiano is obviously on the downward slope, where Nestjukin went up against one of the best lightweights ever and showcased just high upside with his hand speed and his hand power. And so Nestjukin, we haven't seen him fight since March. He's recovering from injuries, but there's incredible upside with this guy.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that if you have never seen him fight, I would go on YouTube and find his fights. I think for people who really monitor everything going on in MMA, he's a known name. But maybe if you only watch UFC events, maybe you only watch Bellator as well, he may not be a guy that you know of, but he is definitely a guy to check out. Now, number 88 is Alistair Overeem. Of course, the Ream. You know, obviously he's on the down slope of his career. I mean, there's no question about that. It was going to be interesting to see him and Walt Harris. I would imagine that the UFC will still look to, that'll be the route they would go there, which, you know, to me was, you know, really a big test for Walt Harris. If Walt Harris could, you know, get past someone like Alistair Overeem, he was going to be a guy that you would start to look at of potentially getting a top five guy, you know, if he got that win. But, you know, Overeem is still a dangerous guy. I mean, we saw him, you know, I mean, for, you know, 24 minutes and, you know, 50 seconds was looking pretty good against Jair Rosenstruck. And then, you know, his lights get knocked out there with 10 seconds left in the fight.
Yeah. I mean, had he won that fight, he'd be higher on this list. He really would have. I mean, Jair, is higher. And, you know, Alistair, I mean, a legendary heavyweight in the sport. I mean, the biggest issue for him has to be drug testing. You know, if this was 10 years ago, we might be talking about him, like, because he fought 10 years ago, but if he kept himself still souped up, because, like, he was so souped up in Strikeforce and in Japan, if he maintained that, he might have been, like, the most dominant UFC heavyweight champion ever. It was unfair when you watch this guy fight, and it's like, he would throw a jab, and he would go out cold. But independent of that, he's always showcased a high degree of skill, and he is on the downward trend. I think he came into the UFC with high expectations, and I don't believe he has met them. But that still doesn't disqualify him from being still, you know, a bottom of the top 10 type heavyweight.
Yeah, I mean, I think the odds of him ever getting back to a UFC title shot, you would feel are unlikely, but man, you just never know in today's world. Number 87 is a guy that, you know, he was, you know, right there close to a UFC title shot, and it just hasn't happened to him from this point. That's Corey Anderson. And, you know, it's with Corey, I mean, obviously we know about, you know, his wrestling abilities, but, you know, obviously getting knocked out there in his last fight, you know, he's a guy, you know, you can't count him out, because at 205 pounds, it's just not like there is a ton of contenders waiting after Dom Jones. Obviously, you've got Jan Blachowicz, and, you know, they're now, you know, Jan and Corey are 1-1. But, you know, you can't help but wonder with Corey Anderson of, has he reached a ceiling, or is there still room for him to potentially grow and maybe eventually get that title shot?
There's definitely room for Corey Anderson to grow, but will he is what we're looking at here, because the clear point where he can grow is with his stand-up and striking, but the development hasn't necessarily been there. With that being said, he still had plenty of success prior to the victory over Blachowicz. He had an impressive four-fight win streak over Johnny Walker, Latifi, Glover Teixeira, Patrick Cummins, and at 30 years old, it's reasonable to expect that he will get the right amount of matchups to justify a light heavyweight title shot in 2022, for example. I feel like 2020 and 2021, I mean, you're looking at fights for guys like Reyes, Thiago Santos. We'll see what happens with Blachowicz. Overall, though, Corey Anderson is a guy who's like a number 6th or 7th ranked light heavyweight, and that's kind of why I have him there.
Yeah, number 86 is a fighter we saw get a title fight in the UFC, and unfortunately for her, it's going to be a part of a highlight reel for a very long time. And that's Jessica Ai, which, I mean, look, 125 pounds is her natural weight class, and it is unfortunate that, you know, for essentially all of her, you know, majority of her UFC run, 125 was not a division for her. It now is. But man, I feel bad for the way of, I don't know if she's ever going to be able to move past that knockout, just because it's always going to be on Valentina Shevchenko's highlight reel.
It was brutal, man. It was absolutely brutal and scary. And Jessica Ai is the type of fighter who you really have to respect her. You have to really respect her, like, tenacious attitude. She had a rough start to her UFC career. She really did. I mean, the record books will reflect only one victory in her first seven fights, because her first fight, a win over Coffin, was overturned due to a marijuana test, which is insane when you really think about it. But since then, since she started fighting at flyweight, she's kind of established herself as the top flyweight not named Valentina Shevchenko, to be honest. And what's striking is the gap in talent between her and Shevchenko. And even though from a skill set standpoint, she may not be as impressive as a Corey Anderson, she has established herself as the top flyweight who doesn't have the championship. And that's kind of why I have her ranked this high.
Yeah, I mean, she's still obviously one of the best at 125 pounds. 85, Rob Font is a guy that I've known for several years, actually originally from Tampa. A lot of people think of him as being a Northeast fighter, but originally from Tampa. And I think one of the most interesting stories with Rob Font is that there was a time in that Northeast regional scene where him and Calvin Kattar were all on this collision course. And basically Tyson Chartier, who now manages both fighters, basically looked at both of them and said, he goes, why are you going to take each other out when you can help build each other? And of course, obviously both of them are one of the best. And, you know, I really feel that, you know, Rob's got the potential to eventually make his way to a title shot. You know, obviously with his knee injury and recovering from that, probably, you know, out all of 2020, you know, how much that sets him back, but he's clearly a guy that could eventually challenge for the 135 pound title in the UFC.
I agree. And I think it'll happen because he's an exciting fighter. I mean, he's 32 years old. Thus far, he's been 7-3 in the UFC. His only three losses are to Petr Munoz, Rafael Sunsau, and John Lineker back in 2016. He's coming off back-to-back wins over Ricky Simon and Sergio Pettis. And overall, Rafon is a very exciting bantamweight with significant striking, well-rounded approach. And with the time off, the hope is the best is ahead for Rafon. So I think as he gets into his age 34 years as a fighter, this is a guy who I think will contend for a bantamweight title. This is one of those divisions that has really been held up, and he's going to get himself an interesting fight whenever he comes back. It's a very tough division that has several other fighters above him, but I have Rob Font here.
84 is an interesting one that you have here, and that's Kevin Lee. And obviously, coming off that loss at UFC Brasilia against Charles Oliveira, you know, he noted after that fight of potentially taking, you know, a lengthy amount of time off. I mean, because he was a guy that, overall, I think the feeling of him for a little while there was, you know, everyone was kind of down on him. And then he goes out there and head kicks Gregor Gillespie out. And of course, he had moved up the TriStar. You're like, okay, Kevin Lee's back. Now he has this setback. You know, clearly he still has the talent. I think, you know, my ultimate question with Kevin Lee is, you know, making 155 pounds at this point in his career. I mean, we saw unable to make weight there at Brasilia, and that's got to be a big question mark with him.
Yeah, it is. And for Kevin Lee, he is the most volatile guy on this list because he has immense upside. We've seen it. It's crazy to think that he debuted in the UFC in 2014. This guy's only 27 years old. He's had a lot of fights within the UFC. And his last six fights have been a testament to where he's at right now. Several tough losses, but those losses have been against some of the best fighters in the lightweight division. Oliveira, Dos Anjos, Iaquinta, Tony Ferguson. I'm not sure where he will fight next. It probably should be welterweight. The thing is, the reason why I have him here is his flash knockout win over Gillespie, his victory over Edson Barboza. At 27 years old, Kevin Lee showcases an incredible potential. And the idea is, if he listens to his corner, if he invests in himself, he has championship level talent. But he certainly has a lot of negative momentum.
Number 83 on your list is another fighter we've seen with the weigh-in issues, and that's Ray Bourque. Obviously, a very talented fighter, but you know, you look at 125 pounds. I mean, there's going to be questions there. You know, he was going to fight at UFC 249 at 135 pounds. I mean, look, I think for him to have potentially to get back to a title shot, to me, it's got to be at 25. I don't see it happen at 35.
Yeah, this is a guy with a very, very small frame, and. And you look at UFC rankings, I mean, he doesn't find himself on either top 15, but I mean, the issue is the weight. I mean, he's missed bantamweight, for God's sakes. He missed the bantamweight limit against Casey Kenney. But I have him here because he is a guy who is incredibly talented, well-skilled, and it wouldn't be surprising if he earns another flyweight championship opportunity. He had a lot of inactivity. He didn't fight the entire year in 2018, and he's starting to get things back together. I think the Arizona native just has to figure out how to consistently cut to 125. And he's one of the top fighters in the flyweight division if he can actually, you know, make the weight class that he's missed weight in three times.
Now, number 82 is a fighter that I think if we fast forward a year from now, I think they'll be much higher than 82.
It depends. It really does. Because number 82 is Kayla Harrison. And the reason why I say it depends is she's a lightweight. And this women's lightweight division does not give her much opportunity to prove herself. There just isn't a lot of talent out there at a high level when you contrast it with the women's strawweight division. With the women's bantamweight division. So she will slowly but surely move her way up, but it's going to be very difficult for Kayla Harrison to find a lot of names that are going to establish her credibility. But she's been so damn dominant in the PFL.
You know, I think part of that also, Daniel, is about of a year from now, is the PFL still in existence? I mean, that's obviously a question mark. They've put a ton of money into that promotion. And I kind of do feel like the next season of whenever, whether that's, you know, this year or next year, when you obviously for the fighters in PFL, you hope it's this year, is of, you know, if she were to become a free agent and, you know, man, if Bellator could give her a Chris Cyborg fight, that's a fight that interests you. You know, but ultimately, you know, and she's, you know, obviously talked about that, you know, she wants to be able to fight at 155 pounds of being, you know, more of a natural weight for her. But when you look at Bellator and the UFC, if she's ever going to go to those organizations, I think she's going to have to understand that, you know, it's going to have to be at 145 pounds.
Yeah, there just isn't another challenger at 155. And there's a lot of money to be made in the Kayla Harrison business. She's a star on the rise, and she's passed every test. So she is one of those fighters where she has the upward arrow, where if we do this again next year, hopefully there's not another pandemic. If we do this again next year, she will continue to rise, because there just isn't, she has great talent, and there also isn't an opponent that can take it away from her.
Yeah, I mean, she's clearly the face of the PFL. There's no one that would deny that, but I think the problem that the PFL faces with her is the fact of, what is the fight that ultimately gets you excited? I mean, we all would love to see her and Sarah Kaufman, but outside of that, I think that's a problem the PFL faces, is what is the big fight that you can make for her?
I don't know. I mean, well, is it, it feels like it's like, all right, let's just hope we can put her in there against Sarah Kaufman again. I mean, it's got to be acquiring a free agent, cut in a deal with Bellator. But for her, the number one way to make big-time fights is to figure out how to get to 145.
No, no question about that. And number 81 will be the last fighter we talk about here. And that's Paul Felder. Obviously, we saw his fight against Dan Hooker, a very fun fight to watch. I mean, look, if you want to go back and watch a fight that's happened this year, that's a very good fight to go back and watch. I know there's fights, it seems like, aired every day on ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News. You know, Paul Felder, you know, obviously the emotions got to him at the end of that fight. You know, he's all signs are that he's going to keep fighting. But, you know, I look at him and you know, I do wonder, you know, what is, if at where he's at in his career, obviously it's about, you know, trying to get to that title. You know, I just wonder what is the path for him to get to the title shot?
I don't know, man. It's a tough road, and he's going to have to piece together win after win. And the reason why Paul Felder's so high is a testament to how good this lightweight division is. You're going to find a lot of lightweights that are part of the top 80 for sure. For Paul Felder, look, he took on a guy in Dan Hooker, and it was a razor-thin decision that could have gone either way. Dan Hooker's going to have a big-time fight going forward. But the problem for Hooker, the problem for Felder, is the roadmap to a title fight represents a couple of tough cookies. Tony Ferguson is a tough fighter to beat. Justin Gaethje is a tough fighter to beat. Dustin Poirier is a tough fighter to beat. Those are elite-level lightweights where it would be shocking if Felder or Hooker beat them. But there isn't a whole lot between them and those guys. So who knows? I don't foresee Felder challenging for a title. He got really close to it. But even like a matchup against someone like Charles Oliveira, I would feel more confident picking Oliveira against Felder. But Felder's a top 10 lightweight. And to get that high in a division that's the toughest division in the entire sport justifies a spot on the list.
I think that's one of the interesting things about the UFC going forward here in 2020 is kind of how does this lightweight division shake out? I mean, obviously we all want to see Khabib versus Tony, and, you know, hopefully that fight, maybe it happens in September. I know that's a date that Khabib Nurmagomedov has mentioned, but, you know, when you look at that, you know, let's just say it is Khabib versus Ferguson. You know, then of course is where does Conor McGregor kind of fall in this? Who wins the red panties night against Conor McGregor? Is it Justin Gaethje? You know, do they still try to go forward with Dustin Poirier versus Dan Hooker? You know, then you mentioned, I mean, maybe Paul Felder versus Charles Oliveira is a natural matchup that kind of gets made.
Yeah. I think those two dancing partners might be the two without a partner. So they'll just find, one another, and damn, that's one hell of a fight. This lightweight division is so exciting, and when we talk about things we're looking forward to, is just to get those lightweight fights. I mean, to me, the two divisions, if we're power ranking divisions in the UFC right now, the two I'm most interested in currently would be lightweight and men's bantamweight. Those two weight classes at the very top have so many intriguing options of exciting fighters that have a real roadway to a championship opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know if you have seen the back and forth going on between Henry Cejudo and Cody Garbrandt. The most recent tweet to record this show was Henry Cejudo going, "Just a little reminder, Cody, no chin garbage. I kill the killers." And it's a photo of TJ Dillashaw knocking out Henry Cejudo with TJ Dillashaw knocking out Cody Garbrandt with a head kick. And then, of course, what Henry Cejudo did to TJ Dillashaw with a head kick. And also, it should be noted that, I don't know if you saw this, I guess it was a week or two ago, that TJ Dillashaw is actually expected that he'll get a title shot on his return, which will be January of 2021.
A lot of title shots, and there's only one champion. So I think, Henry Cejudo has set the record for most theoretical fights booked, right? He had a fight against Benavidez, a fight against Dillashaw, Garbrandt, Cruz, Aldo, Moraes. Damn, let's fight Peter Young. Let's fight Aljamain Sterling. Henry Cejudo does a lot of talking for a guy who doesn't fight too often. And I tell you what, that's a dig, but it shouldn't be, because like the reason why he doesn't fight is he's had a lot of injury issues. Damn, I tell you what, those guys at bantamweight have injury issues. Cruz, Garbrandt, wow. They got to start doing that naked exercise that Austin Vanderford and Paige VanZant are doing. Maybe that's the way to get therapy. I can't unsee my Instagram feed when those two are on it.
I just saw that she's now doing Cameo, and I saw it's like $100 a pop. I'm sitting there going, oh my God. You know, she's talking about how, you know, for people to put her request in for her, you know, what her to say, you know, and I'm just like, oh man, I can only imagine what people are requesting.
Yeah, probably her reading Bible verses, I would assume.
But here's the thing about men's bantamweight is if you tell me Cejudo's fighting Aljamain Sterling next, sign me up. Can't wait to see that fight. If you tell me he's fighting Peter Yan next, sign me up. Can't wait to see the fight. I'm not exactly all in on Cejudo Dominic Cruz or Cejudo Jose Aldo.
Yeah. I think Aldo and Cruz are, it's a nice little microcosm of the decisions the UFC makes. They'll go towards that past champion getting a title shot they don't deserve over the rightful contender who showcased the skills inside the cage in the year 2020.
Look, if you told me we're going Henry Cejudo versus Aljamain Sterling, Peter Yan's the backup, and on the same card we're doing Dominic Cruz versus Jose Aldo, okay, I can dig that.
That's a hell of a card. I would love to see that fight between Cruz and Aldo. That's a hell, because what I love about that fight is, like, that's a legacy fight. I mean, that's like a WEC dream match, essentially. If we're power ranking like the top WEC fighters, I mean, Cruz and Aldo are top three with favor.
Hell, I mean, yeah, you could probably do an all bantamweight card. We have headliner Henry Cejudo versus Aljamain Sterling. We go co-main event Dominic Cruz versus Jose Aldo. Okay, then we go Peter Yan versus Corey Sandhagen, and let's go Cody Garbrandt versus Marlon Moraes.
That's true, man. Yeah, Marlon Moraes is left there. Damn, Garbrandt Moraes would be. That's a rough fight for Garbrandt. And yeah, you put Fawn on that card. John Dodson's interesting, and Cody Stamen. I don't even think I mentioned Rivera and Munoz. This division is sick.
I don't like the thought of Cody Garbrandt talking about dropping the 125, though.
No, he's just too big, man. His frame is huge, and it just seems really dangerous.
Yeah, and it's also the way he's been knocked out, you know, at 135 pounds against TJ. I just, man, is going to 25 the best thing? That would, you know, and look, we would only know until if he tried to make 125 how he performed. But, you know, it's just you looked at the optics and outside looking in, and you're sitting there going, oh, man, I don't know if that's such a great idea, Cody.
Yeah, it's not. It really isn't. I mean, that's a big guy in terms of how tall he is.
Yeah, I mean, it's but yeah, I mean, look, the one thing is there's still a ton of talk about here in the world of MMA. Of course, as always, love the support that we get for this podcast. Of course, great way to show your support is by leaving a rating review, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, or TuneIn Radio. Of course, we are here every week to talk about what's going on in the world of MMA. Be sure to give Daniel a follow on Twitter at Daniel Galvan, DGG. Of course, Daniel, I think you might need a haircut, bro. Look, I'm in the same boat, man. Sometimes I just got to put a hat on to contain this fluff.
Yeah, I look like a gorilla, though. I mean, hair's coming out of everywhere, and I don't know what's going on. I mean, I need some tutorials on how to cut my hair, I think is the issue here.
Dude, I was thinking about this the other day because, like, I need a haircut, bro. I need a haircut bad. I don't do the long hair, man. But I'm sitting there going, whenever we get back to a normal life, when a barbershop is open again, what is the line going to be like at the barbershop the first day?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's the one business that's going to get right back on track because everyone's going to need a damn haircut.
Dude, like if you're the barber, do you do like an auction type to see who comes up next? All right, $20. Who's gonna give me 30? Who's gonna give me 40?
You might as well make some money off of everyone's misfortune. I cannot wait to get a haircut. I tell you that much. I cannot wait.
Cause like I just couldn't like grab the and shave my head. I couldn't do that. I could not do that. I got too big of a head, Daniel.
Yeah, it would look awful. I mean, the bald look only works if you're balding, and it's you got to do it.
Oh, if I was going balding, yes, I'll go Mr. Clean. But yeah, I'm not doing like the hair on the sides, bald on the top. No, the whole thing would go off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, God, I need a haircut badly. I mean, you almost wonder if that's an essential service. Ooh. I need it.
If WWE is an essential service, a barbershop is.
Damn right. That's one great way of looking at it.
just trying to point out the positives. But yeah, the barbershop is definitely going to be one of those businesses that's going to be booming when we get out of this safe at home orders or wherever, maybe call wherever you do live. But that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. As I mentioned, be sure to give Daniel a follow on Twitter at Daniel Galvan DGG, and I am at Jason_Floyd. Of course, you can always check out this podcast on RadioInfluence.com, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, and Google Podcast.
This is a Real Animals with Captain Mike Anderson Quick Fix on Radio Influence Tampa Bay.
Very fortunate to get some time with my good friend and the head coach for the Columbus Blue Jackets and former head coach of our Tampa Bay Lightning here. John Tortorella joins me today.
We had such a young team there, and quite honestly, a young team and young coaching staff, and we really didn't know what we were doing. We were just playing. We used Andy to get that message to the players, and the players use Andy as a messenger getting to us also. David was a very important guy as far as being that conduit. I put him there, and also the acquisition of Tim Taylor. Those two guys there were huge pieces to the puzzle for us in winning a Stanley Cup. And, you know, the funny thing is, Mike, I thought we were a pretty clean living team back in the day when we won that Stanley Cup. And we were going through a process as a team. As I've gone to a few of the reunions, and now we have a different relationship, which is really cool. And it's not coach player anymore. It's a group of champions of that team. I listened to the story, and led by Andy, you know, when they were getting in at night and all the shenanigans that were going on, and I didn't even know this was going on. And so, yeah, that has been an eye opener to me. But I will say this. We have people now that are yes, sir, no, sir. They have their entourage. They have their strength coaches. They know how to eat, this, that, the other thing. I think you need to be able to go out as a team, be in a bar. Maybe some stuff happens, nothing dangerous, but stuff happens. And you need that type of atmosphere of missing curfew and causing a little trouble. I think that's huge for camaraderie within a hockey club. And I thought Andy handled that really well. I didn't know what was going on at that point in time, but as I listened to the story and listened to them now talk, it was really important for that team as far as making us a close-knit group.
The Real Animals Podcast with Captain Mike Anderson can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RITampaBay.com.